Welcome to the Lost Ways of Knowing podcast. Your host is Matthew Krepps, religious scholar, philosopher, and co-founder of Circle Yoga Shala. The Lost Ways of Knowing teaches a basic history of the Indian traditions that are central to modern yoga. If you're a yoga teacher or practitioner, you must listen for a clear, concise, and provocative engagement with how this history might apply to today's world. The ultimate aim of this podcast is to initiate a dialogue about awakening and overcoming self-deception, leading to deeper intimacy with what is real. Matthew's coming to you from his home, Circle Yoga Shala, which is also a working farm and yoga teacher, yoga therapy training facility.
Welcome, everyone.
We're continuing this section of episodes in the last part of season 5 as we discuss what I call traditional definitions of enlightenment, where we're looking at several of the sort of major traditions that are generally given the name of yoga in some way or other, to see how they all have a particular idea that liberation and freedom is the goal of yoga, but they don't exactly have the same idea about how that is achieved, or maybe not necessarily even what that means when it is achieved. Last time we discussed the three major interpretations of Vedanta that arise from the three great commentators, Shankaracharya, who taught Advaita Vedanta, or pure non-dual Vedanta, Ramanujacharya, who taught qualified non-dual Vedanta, or Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, and Madhvacharya, who is a teacher of Dvaita Vedanta, or the pure dual Vedanta. Now, I won't recap everything that we said about the perspectives of these three great commentators. Just let me remind you that each of the perspectives that comes from these three great teachers centers around the relationship between the individual soul, which we call the Atman or the Jiva, and the source of all things, which is known as Brahman. Also, there are differences of opinion about the ontological status of the temporal world, or the world of our senses, where Shankara seems to suggest at times that it's an illusion, and Madhva and Ramanuja both reject that idea. But This concern about how does the soul relate to the source and what is the reality of the perceived world, those are things that really are perennial throughout the yoga tradition, and everybody's grappling with those ideas in some way or other. And we'll see that this is still the case as we begin to move toward the Patanjala Yoga Shastra, or Patanjali's teaching on yoga and what liberation means according to him. So if you haven't listened to that last episode, I encourage you to go back and spend some time with it, because some of what I say here goes by way of comparison to the insights that it contains. Now, let me start by listing some similarities and differences between where Patanjali's coming from and the general three interpretations that we looked at from Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhvacharya, because the Yoga Sutra comes many hundreds of years after what is called classical Vedanta in the primary Upanishads, and so it inherits many ideas or a concern for many of the same themes. And we see some of the same players, if you will, in his system. So a major thing that is similar between Patanjali and between Vedanta is the misidentification of the true self with that which is transitory or impermanent in some way. And so we have this idea that ignorance, which is called avidya in Patanjali, means I am suffering a case of mistaken identity, that I believe and feel and act as if I am something that I'm not, and namely, as if I am something that is transitory or impermanent, something that could come and go, something that could be born, and something that could die. And as we will see, like in most of Vedanta, this is a mistake. Also, Patanjali's yoga could be called, like we said last time about Vedanta, gnosiological, or some people might say Gnostic. And this means that it is heavily dependent on developing discernment between what is true and what is false, or what is real and what is an illusion. And through this discernment, realizing the sort of ultimate nature of things as a legitimate knowledge that one experiences firsthand. And so discernment and realization are keys to Patanjali's yoga in the same way that they are in Vedanta. Now, specifically like Madhvacharya, Patanjali's cosmology, which means his understanding of the universe, let me just use that word loosely, which comes from something called the Sankhya philosophy. And there's a podcast on Sankhya that's well back at the beginning of this entire endeavor that's worth looking at if you don't know much about Sankhya. But his Sankhya cosmology is dualistic and pluralistic. And so like Madhva, there is a kind of eternal dualism. There is the realm of Purusha, or the realm of the eternal, unconditioned. And then there's the realm of Prakriti, or nature, or the realm of the conditioned. And in Patanjali's system, in the same way that is the case for both Madhvacharya and I believe Ramanujacharya too, there already exists an infinity of eternal, distinct souls. Now, unlike Shankaracharya and like Madhvacharya and Ramanuja, for Patanjali, the world, or the realm of Prakriti, or nature, is real. Specifically for Patanjali, the important thing to realize about nature or the world is that it's not the locus or the ground of our true identity. And its appearance as a changing, moving thing is based on misidentification, or it's based on avidya, the belief and the feeling and the series of actions that emerge when I'm suffering this strange case of misidentification or mistaken identity. That's what makes the world appear for Patanjali. But the world is still real. Now, in another way, Patanjali shares this idea with Vedanta writ large, that action, which in Vedanta was sort of looked at as the Vedic sacrificial ritual. And in Patanjali, it has a little bit of a broader scope than that, but it's still this idea of acting out of desire for a particular reward. Any attachment to that kind of thing is a manifestation of ignorance. And ultimately, the reason that is because action involves change. And when you're dealing with the true identity as being the eternally pre-existent soul, it's a mistake to believe that the soul changes. And so this is really, really revealed in Patanjali's classical definition of yoga, which we're going to look at a little bit more closely in a minute. But let me just go ahead and say it. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. And that means yoga is the cessation of the whirling in the mind or in the chitta. That's a description of stillness. That's a description of what it's like when yoga is happening. Things are becoming still, and action is being transformed into realization for him. Also, because of this basic orientation toward action, like Shankara's Vedanta, Patanjali's yoga is more on the ascetic or renunciate side of the tradition. He doesn't really give you anything when it comes to what his yoga is about. In fact, he, in chapter 3, describes the existence of several miraculous powers that will begin to accrue to the practitioner who is sincere over a long period of time. And he recommends very strongly that those powers be ignored and that one keep focusing on the goal, which is this discernment between the true and the false, and an ultimate disidentification with that which is false. So he's really more of a pulling back away from the world than he is kind of get into things and get your hands dirty.
Looking for a yoga teacher training that goes beyond poses? At Circle Yoga Shala, our 200 and 300 hour programs are immersive journeys into somatic awareness, spiritual depth, and authentic teaching. Rooted in ancient wisdom and modern insight, these trainings are designed to transform your practice and your life. Learn more and apply at CircleYogaShala.com, where yoga isn't performance, it's presence.
Finally, we should say that especially, well, all three great commentators of Vedanta have a devotional element. It's probably stronger in Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya. Patanjali also has a devotional element. It's called Ishvara Pranidhana in the second chapter. It's part of his idea of Kriya Yoga, or the yoga of purification. And so devotion is part of his project, but you should realize that it's not the focus of his project. It's actually a means to a well-rounded approach that includes other things like tapas or burning intensity, renunciation, and svadhyaya, chanting of the scriptures and contemplation of the nature of the self through the traditional revelations. Those three things together aim at the instantiation or the experience of samadhi, the experience of a deep kind of subtle state of consciousness where attention and concentration are unshakable. And this unshakability is not a result of the personal will. It's a result of this kind of specific gravity of things becoming still and the lenses through which we perceive being clarified progressively. So samadhi is the high and subtle state that will allow discernment ultimately to take place, and therefore disidentification from the false to take place. So even though there is a devotional element for him, like there is in the Upanishad, it's not the goal for him. It's a means to another end. Now, I'd like to come at his ideas as briefly as I can. There's a lot that we could do when it comes to speaking about the Yoga Sutra, but we're just going to try to get an idea of what his major understanding of the problem of ignorance is and how it comes about. And this will set us up for discussing what it means for him to get free in a little bit of detail. And so in order to come at this in the simplest way, we should do the first four sutras of the Yoga Sutra, because really those first four constitute the classical definition of yoga as is understood by the traditional Hindu darshana. And this is something that I think everyone who is interested in yoga really should be conversant with to some extent. We work really hard here to get our students to be able to recite in some clear way the classical definition of yoga. And so I'll say it in English. I'm not going to read the Sanskrit just for the sake of time and understanding. So Sutra 1 says, "Now begins the teaching of yoga." Sutra 2 is the definition of what it's like when yoga begins to happen. Yoga is the cessation of the whirling in the mind or in the citta. When that happens, that is the cessation of the whirling, the seer rests or abides in its own form. Otherwise, that means when there is whirling in the mind, the seer is identified with the changing states of mind. So quickly again, now begins the teaching of yoga. Yoga is the cessation of the whirling in the citta or the mind. When cessation takes place, the seer rests or abides in its own form. Otherwise, when there is no cessation of whirling, the seer is identified with the changing states of mind. And so let's go through this just a little bit. Now, we've said before that the problem that Patanjali is outlining is we suffer a case of misidentification. I think I am something that comes and goes. Something that is perceivable with the senses, and all things perceivable with the five external senses are temporal things that come and go, and anyone can pay attention to this at any time. And so bondage and ignorance arise from identification. And the Sanskrit word that Patanjali uses to describe identification at the most basic level is samyoga, S-A-M-Y-O-G-A, samyoga. And that prefix sam is related to our word the same or like. And so samyoga is the yoga of sameness, the yoga of likeness. Sometimes this is translated as conjunction. Sometimes this conjunction is explained as like a close proximity between the soul and something else. And so the problem is that I am, quote unquote, yogad, as if I were the same with something that is impermanent. And so my soul suffers a case of misidentification. Now, what specifically does this mean? We mentioned that in Patanjali's cosmology, which comes from Sankhya, there is the element of Purusha, the unconditioned eternal realm, and this is where all the souls are, all the individual Atmans are in this eternal unconditioned realm. And then we mentioned the realm of nature, which itself is eternal. It doesn't come and go itself, but nature is in constant motion, giving birth to objects, and those objects are coming into being and passing away, and this is what nature does. And so these two eternal realms are always existing, always already existing, and at certain times, one of the objects that is produced by nature is called the citta, which means the mind in many contexts, and that mind is also called the antakarana, or the quote-unquote inner organ. And this is a very subtle object, but it's something that is born from nature, and it's something that's impermanent, and it dies. And when the citta emerges out of nature, and an individual soul is in close proximity with it, or samyogad to it, the light of the soul, which is eternal, and light is the fundamental characteristic of the soul for Patanjali, the light of the soul shines through the citta, or the mind, and the world appears. All the things of nature, all the colors, all the smells, all the ideas and feelings that I am a separate individual and that things are happening to me and I am the experiencer of sorrows and joys and pains and so on and so forth. But this is actually not the case, because the soul cannot be born and it cannot die, and the citta is always born and it will always pass away. And this temporary identification between the two, or this conjunction or samyoga between the two, is what gives rise to avidya, and therefore what drives the cycle of birth and death. And freedom from that cycle is, in this context, like in Vedanta, the goal of liberation. And so if we have samyoga, we have the experience of quote-unquote whirling in the mind, constant motion, things coming and going, and the joys and sorrows that come from attaching to those things, and hoping that they never pass away because they're really pleasurable, or the revulsion to the arising of certain things in the mind because those are doubtful, or those are painful things, or those are scary things, and so on and so forth. And so this samyoga is coincident with, or an expression of, this whirling of the mind. And remember that yoga, according to Patanjali, is cessation of that whirling. And so remember Sutra 4 then, when Patanjali says, otherwise, when there is no cessation of the whirling, the seer is identified with the changing states of the mind. And so what is needed in this context is, let's just stay with the classical definition, nirodha, or cessation. The beginning of the stilling of this constant movement of the mind. My teacher translated nirodha as surrender. Some people say cessation. I have seen it translated as control in other places. I don't think that's the best translation myself. To get at the idea of what this cessation means, we can see the prefix in the word N-I, which is not a negation. It doesn't mean not. What it means is it suggests deep within. And so the kind of cessation of the whirling that we're talking about here that is Patanjali's definition of yoga in the classical sense is something that begins to happen to us at the deepest part of us, the most subtle part. And this usually is a result of like an experience of beauty or an aha moment or suddenly being granted insight into a deluded state that I've been suffering under. My teacher gave examples of experiencing mercy, being shown mercy, or being graced enough to be courageous enough to give mercy. All of these experiences are experiences that kind of stun the mind into a stillness, and that stillness starts at a deep, deep level. Now, I've mentioned these experiences because I want you to understand that there is a kind of, from time to time, a stilling of the mind that happens naturally as a result of just being a human with an attention that is capable of being captured by things that are very profound, as well as things that are not profound and trivial and meaningless. So those profound or profound experiences show us something about the stillness of the mind. Yoga is a kind of practice that wants that stillness to become very instructive and very important for us. And so the teachers are hoping that through the practices and the orientations that we take on when we begin to do yoga, that we will become more conversant with this stillness and it will be possible to experience it in ways that are very transformative if we continue to practice. And so in that deep stillness of Nirodha, something is possible. And what is possible is called viveka, or discernment. And the prefix for the word viveka is vi, and that means to distinguish or to separate, or to, like you are cutting one thing away from another thing, or seeing one thing as extremely different or over and against another thing. And veka is related to the word Veda, which has connotations of a kind of knowledge. And so this idea of discernment is important. And remember that it arises in this stillness of the mind that is Patanjali's yoga. And when we are discerning, we can see the reality of the eternal soul and the non-reality of the transient mind that we are identified with in the state of ignorance. And this means that it is possible for the seer to be disidentified from the transitory. And it's very interesting that Patanjali calls this V-yoga, V-I-yoga, the yoga of separation, as it were, the yoga of discernment or distinction, as it were. So recall very quickly that ignorance arises from Sam-yoga, the yoga of sameness, and the solution to this is a kind of discernment in a profound stillness of the mind that allows the possibility of disidentification, or V-yoga, where the soul can be abstracted, so to speak, from this identification with the changing states of nature. And as to kind of give an idea about what this would look like, in identification, the light of the soul is shining through the citta into the world, illuminating the world and the changing things that happen in the world, and the soul takes itself to be that in some way. But as the mind comes to stillness, because of a series of subtle events that are a little too complicated for me to go in here, just take my word for that, the light of the soul begins to be reflected back into the soul itself, and the soul begins to perceive its own eternal nature. And therefore, to see and know clearly that in contemplation, there is the realization that I am not the changing states of mind, that I can disidentify from those states, and that I can realize freedom. And so this moment where the light of the soul is turned away from the changing world and focused in contemplation of its own eternal nature is what is described in the third sutra that composes our classical definition of yoga. When that happens, that, in this case being the cessation of the whirling, the seer rests or abides in its own form. Svarupyam. Sva means, S-V-A means self, and rupyam comes from rupa, which means form or name. And so notice that the seer is resting or abiding, coming to a kind of profound contemplative stillness, and also it is quote-unquote shaped in the way that is proper to it. The form of the soul is what is realized, because in identification, the changing forms of the mind are what the soul takes itself to be. Now that contemplation has been instantiated through a profound stillness, it sees exactly what it is, and this is equivalent with resting or abiding in its own form. And so this is very interesting because I think it gives a profound commentary on the diversity of visions of what yoga means. What I mean by that is we've all heard that the word yoga means union. And I talked about this a little bit in the last episode of the podcast, where when we look closely at Vedanta, we see that union really is not taken to be, number one, the same in all cases, and therefore, number two, not ultimately valuable in some cases. In this case, because Patanjali's yoga is called V-yoga, the yoga of separation, you can see that Samyoga, or the yoga of misidentification or conjunction of the soul with the transitory, is a kind of union that is equivalent with ignorance and therefore being trapped in the cycle of birth and death. And so for Patanjali, V-yoga, or the yoga of separation, is his goal. He's hoping that the soul will realize its own eternal nature that would be resting in its form. This will free it from any liability to the birth and death cycle, because the light of the soul will be turned toward contemplation of itself. The world eventually will come to a kind of phenomenological stillness, at least. We will not be looking into the world with our light, we will be contemplating our own eternal nature with our light. And so in the advent of liberation for Patanjali, the world will disappear from our focus. It won't cease to exist, but because the world has no light of its own, because light only comes from the seer, the world will still be moving and doing what it does, but it's not where the point of focus is. And so it's very important to see that, according to Patanjali, union is the problem. What needs to be the case is that we need to be disidentified from that which we are habitually and unconsciously identified with or unified with. And when this happens, we will realize directly and internally and intuitively, not through the five external senses, who we actually are, and we will escape the birth and death cycle and all of its pain and all of its uncertainty and all of the problems that arise with it. And so I hope that this has been interesting. We sure appreciate you listening. Give us a comment somewhere if you're listening to the podcast. Send us a question. We love that. God bless all of you, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Lost Ways of Knowing podcast. We hope it was informative and also inspiring for you. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast and leave a review for us so other yoga teachers and practitioners can find us. For in-person opportunities to learn and grow in a community setting, visit CircleYogaShala.com.